It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania is the top law enforcement officer for the region, prosecuting federal crimes ranging from national security to civil rights, from public corruption to narcotics. Scott Brady was sworn in last year, succeeding David Hickton, who resigned, as is common practice, following the election of Donald Trump as president. Scott Brady, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. It's great to be here.
You took over last December after a stint in private practice litigation, 6 years with the U.S. Attorney's Office prior to that, chasing some drug traffickers and a variety of violent white-collar crimes. How have you found the job so far?
It's great to be back at the Department of Justice. The thing that I'm reminded of when I walk in every day is both what a privilege it is to represent our community, and more importantly, what exceptional people we have protecting us. And so to come back and to have the opportunity to lead that group of men and women is exceptional. It's humbling, and it's fantastic to be back.
How did that previous experience in the office inform your approach as now head of the office?
Many of our young attorneys had never been through an administration change, right? So they were hired under previous U.S. Attorney Dave Hickton and the Obama administration, and very ably effectuated the priorities of that administration, that office. And so I could foresee that there might be some trepidation, new guy coming in, Trump appointee, what's this going to look like? How's this going to change? And so my speech was, hey, guys, you've done these cases before, right? You have done white-collar cases. You have prosecuted opioid cases or firearm cases. It's just a reallocation of resources. So the new administration, the Attorney General and the President absolutely have the right to give us our marching orders and define what the priorities are and what the needs are. We contextualize those to Western Pennsylvania. And so our mission is an apolitical mission. And that's what I communicated. That's what I learned as an AUSA. We are not a political institution.
You are a political organization, but you are appointed by the top politician in the nation in this case. How can you keep that distinction?
I like to express it in a reductionist way. As a caveman lawyer, I say, well, think of the lanes that we have under the Constitution. And we have Article 1 lanes, Article 2 lanes, and Article 3 lanes. And we're in the Article 2 lane. And public policy debates are important, and reasonable people can disagree about, you know, what our public policy should be on immigration or on marijuana, as, you know, a robust debate is going on here in Pennsylvania, or any number of things. Death penalty, for example. I actually just interviewed a young woman for a position and extended her an offer and asked her about how she would feel if she had to stand up and advocate for the death penalty if there were a case, God forbid. And I said, I don't care what your personal preferences on that or your position. And we could have that conversation over a beer another time. But as it impacts your role in our office and your execution of our priorities and enforcement of the law under an understanding of the rule of law, can you do that, right? Divorced from politics. And so that's how I see it. And that's what is affirmed with every conversation I have in Maine Justice with the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, and what I was taught as a young prosecutor. We're all stripes. We're Republican, Democrat, Obama supporters, Hillary supporters, President Trump supporters. Doesn't matter. The mission's the same. The mandate's the same.
Your predecessor, David Hickton, spent a lot of time going after cyber criminals, China, Russia. How do your priorities compare?
We have many of the same priorities because the needs are similar. The number one priority for any U.S. attorney post 9/11 is anti-terrorism and keeping our community safe from terrorist attacks. In terms of the priorities that are handed down from the administration and the department, they are opioids and violent crime. The Attorney General speaks to those all the time. And then the nice thing about this administration is the Attorney General was a former U.S. attorney, and so he has very intentionally reversed what we had seen for, say, 30 years since the Reagan administration of a centralization of power and decision-making within the department in Washington. And he said, no, what I'm going to do, and I don't think this gets a lot of press, there's a lot of noise about what happens in D.C. and with the Attorney General, but what he has communicated to all of us as U.S. attorneys is, I'm going to paint with broad brushstrokes what my priorities are, and I'm going to give you your marching orders, but with a classic Catholic sense of subsidiarity, you are in the best place to effectuate those and allocate resources to accomplish them on the ground, because what the needs are of the opioid epidemic in Western Pennsylvania are going to be radically different than what they are in Vermont, or immigration here looks different than on the border in the Southern District of Texas. And so we're looking at everything from, you know, the Jamaican lottery scam that we prosecuted recently that was really going after seniors in our community, to nation state actors that are doing things that nobody will ever hear about if we don't bring them to light and prosecute them.
Your counterpart, William McSwain, a current U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, has said he wants to focus on violent crimes and the opioid epidemic, plus enforcing immigration laws. You have mentioned violent crime as a priority and the opioid crisis. What about the enforcing of immigration laws? Is that true for the Western District as well?
It definitely is. The administration has a zero tolerance policy, as you're aware and your listeners are aware. And we embrace that. So what does that look like contextualized to the Western District? Well, at the height of any administration, we typically see anywhere from 40 to 50 to 70 cases where a federal criminal charge is brought against someone who is here illegally. Now, that's separate and apart from any administrative proceedings that ICE and INS may bring against someone who is found here illegally. We identify people who are repeatedly removed from the country and or who have engaged in criminal conduct in the present, so they are caught while doing something they shouldn't be doing, breaking the law, or they have a history, especially a violent history. We prioritize those. So if you have been here multiple times and you have a violent history, then we are going to charge you with a felony under the United States Code, and we're going to prosecute you, you're going to spend time in jail, and then you're going to be removed back to your home country.
I think some are concerned about what is the serious crime. For instance, Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Bob Casey and others in his party have been pretty vocal opponents of strict deportation and detainment policies that have targeted the undocumented immigrants. I'm thinking of Martin Esquivel Hernandez, father of two, was deported last year for felony illegal entry after being cited twice for driving without a license. Now, this was before your time as head of the office, but have you heard from the senator or others on either side of the aisle about your immigration policies thus far?
I have not. I'm not familiar with that case, though it's not unlikely that something like that would cross my desk now. I think what I'm hearing from Senator Toomey is that stepping back from any individual case, there is a question of what does the rule of law mean in this context, and does it mean anything? The policy debate should go on about that, but we will enforce the laws that Congress has passed, and we will effectuate the priorities of the administration.
In April, you announced 39 indictments in connection with one of the largest cocaine rings in Western Pennsylvania history. 3 months later, you followed with 121 counts against a former suburban Pittsburgh physician for what your office described as hundreds of thousands of overprescribed opioids. I understand that indictment was the first under a new database program from the Department of Justice. What else can we expect from that database?
That was the Dr. Zielke case. And Dr. Zielke ran a holistic treatment center out of three locations in Western Pennsylvania. And what we are seeing from certain medical professionals are practices that are outside of the bounds of what a reasonable medical professional would do in terms of treatment and prescribing. And what this new initiative does is it identifies the outliers. And so let me say at the outset, 99% of medical professionals are doing this the right way, and they are responsibly treating their patients, and they are prescribing opioids in a responsible way. But what we are doing with our data analytics packages that we're getting from Washington is we're identifying those outliers. So where is that 1% that is really abusing their privilege to serve our community? And what we see are similar practices. We see an all-cash business. We see people coming in from out of state who are going into clinics or doctor's offices, and they're being seen for 30 seconds, 60 seconds. There's no treatment plan. There are not markers of responsible medical practice. Once they get on our radar screen, we then investigate them like we would almost any drug trafficker or white-collar criminal. And so we are going after them aggressively. Since this new program was launched by the Department of Justice, our office has more prosecutions of doctors and medical professionals than any other office in the country. We've prosecuted 17, and there's a lot more to come.
Let's talk about another drug, marijuana. 9 states have legalized recreational marijuana, another 20, including Pennsylvania, have legalized medical marijuana. Financial institutions are very hesitant to engage with marijuana-related companies doing business legally in these states as a result of Attorney General Sessions rescinding an Obama administration document that gave them a sense that they would be not targeted. So will you target these businesses which are legal in Pennsylvania?
That's a great question, and that's one that is ongoing throughout the country. I'm a part of a working group with the Attorney General and other U.S. attorneys around the country that talks about marijuana, marijuana enforcement. And the nice thing is we here in Pennsylvania aren't looking at this issue in a vacuum. It's not like we're the first to the table. We have colleagues in California, Colorado, Washington, and Oregon that are basically 4 years ahead of us.
And you just named states that legalize recreational marijuana.
That's right. Yeah, they're 3 years ahead of where I think the industry would like to be with full legalization of recreational marijuana. And so we can see what the positive benefits have been. Sounds like almost all of this discussion and debate, again, in the policy sphere, is about what kind of resources can be brought to the public fisc that can be redeployed for other good uses. In the meantime, on the law enforcement side, marijuana is against federal law. So until that's changed, our marching orders are pretty clear.
Scott Brady is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for joining us on The Confluence.
No, thank you so much, Kevin. It's great to be here.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, Pittsburgh has more than 460 bridges, but one stands out for its nod to colonial history. You can now buy renters or homeowners insurance through an app, but can you change the insurance industry's image? Later on Marketplace Tech, how startups are trying to reinvent insurance for the urban-dwelling millennial. The last element of a memorial honoring victims of the Flight 93 terrorist attacks was dedicated in Shanksville over the weekend. WESA's Katie Meyer takes you there 17 years after 9/11. And as we approach a handful of tight midterm election contests, who's funding whom? Those stories and more coming up on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Have you ever wondered what Mars sounds like? Mickey Hart has. The Grateful Dead's second drummer recently teamed up with Nobel laureate astrophysicist and cosmologist George Smoot to record the rhythms of deep space and translate them into sounds which can be perceived by human beings. To the average Earthling, it may sound bizarre, but Mickey Hart is not your average human. As a member of the Grateful Dead, a musical instrument inventor, and a lifelong collector of sound samples, he's pursued the music of our universe probably more than any other person has. Mickey Hart turns 75 today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. The 40th Street Bridge, connecting Pittsburgh's Lawrenceville neighborhood with the borough of Millville, is unlike the remainder of the city's more than 460 bridges. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley looks at what makes this span different.
The three light blue arches supporting the 40th Street Bridge appear to bounce across the Allegheny River. On the concrete deck above, drivers, runners, and cyclists make their way back and forth from Route 28 to Lawrenceville. Listener April Fridges crosses this bridge a lot and says she was intrigued by the colorful seals fixed to the railings.
We are a city of bridges, and I feel like a lot of our bridges aren't hand-painted as intricately as that bridge is. I noticed that the seals tend to be states, and I noticed a lot of the states repeated.
Listener Alexis DeBoer noticed the seals while stuck in traffic earlier this summer.
And I just kind of looked out at the river and suddenly saw something on the side of the bridge and said, "Does that say New Hampshire?"
These 14 seals, or shields, are a tribute to American colonial history, according to Lawrenceville Historical Society's Jim Woodarchik.
They represent the first 13 colonies of the United States, and the seal of Allegheny County. And they're repeated constantly. There are 292 of these shields.
Since their installation, the shields have been restored several times. They were first painted in 1976, the country's bicentennial, and then again in 2003. And their nod to American history is purposeful. The span's official name is the Washington Crossing Bridge. In addition to the name, it includes another salute to the country's first president.
On each corner of the bridge on both sides of the river are miniature Washington monuments.
The 2,300-foot bridge was conceived just after World War I, when industrial and business leaders needed an efficient, sturdy route to get to and from Pittsburgh's northern suburbs and the eastern neighborhoods. A nearby bridge, the Ewalt's Bridge, wasn't up to the task, mostly because it was made of wood.
It was subject to fire. There were actually several fires in it. It was not geared for automobile traffic, and it was a toll bridge.
Back then, most bridges were built and financed by private companies, often through toll collection. It wasn't until after World War I that Allegheny County decided to buy all the region's toll bridges and make them free. The 1920s and 30s were the golden age of infrastructure design and construction in the county, and officials were designing bridges to be beautiful.
They want them to be aesthetically appealing to the public because we're using public funds, and they are to be durable.
The county hired a hotshot architect named Benno Jansen. He had previously designed the Pittsburgh Athletic Association Club in Oakland, the William Penn Hotel downtown, and a handful of stately homes in Sewickley Heights and Fox Chapel. He designed the bridge to be three lanes, one each way and one for a streetcar, and made sure its arches were high off the river to accommodate boat traffic. Lawrenceville Historical Society President Tom Powers says when the bridge opened, there was a parade for several miles.
This was made to be not just another bridge, but, you know, making a historical statement. And they glommed on the fact that this is supposedly where George Washington crossed the river.
This spot is highly controversial among local historians. Some say it was farther up the river. Some say it was closer to downtown. And crossed isn't exactly accurate either. By most accounts, Washington nearly drowned in the Allegheny. Of course he didn't, and the bridge is just one of the many tributes in Pittsburgh to the first president. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Good Question is a regular feature on 90.5 WESA, where we investigate what you've always wondered about Pittsburgh. Check out other stories and submit a question of your own at WESA.FM. This is The Confluence. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. 17 years ago today, on September 11th, 2001, four planes were hijacked by terrorists and crashed, two taking down the Twin Towers in New York City, one at the Pentagon, and one in a remote Pennsylvania field. That last plane, United Airlines Flight 93, was diverted from its likely target, the U.S. Capitol, by its passengers and crew. All 40 were killed. Now, 90.5 WESA's Katie Meyer reports, their families and friends have dedicated the final piece of a memorial commemorating them. It's called the Tower of Voices.
The newest and last feature of the Flight 93 National Memorial is a 93-foot-tall tower designed to hold 40 massive wind chimes. And on the day of its long-awaited dedication, it stands out starkly against the clouds as buckets of rain pour down on a crowd that, steadfastly, came out to the park anyway. Inside a tent at the base of the monument, family members of those who died on Flight 93 are gathered. 17 years ago, they were strangers. Now, they're old friends.
When we come to this anniversary, to this dedication, and we get to see people we haven't seen for a year, 3 years, 5 years, time doesn't seem to matter there.
Debbie Borza lost her 20-year-old daughter on Flight 93. Diora Bodley was the youngest person killed in the crash, and Borza says since then, getting the memorial made has given her direction.
17 years, you know, my daughter would be 37. It's as if it were yesterday.
Architect Paul Murdoch has overseen the design of the park since 2005. He says the Tower of Voices was the most ambitious part of the memorial. But just a few weeks before the dedication, he got word most of the massive custom-made chimes wouldn't be done in time. Eight of them are in place, though. And eventually there will be one for each of the people lost. Murdoch says it'll create a visceral experience.
It's all about remembering. And I mean, this is what a memorial needs to do. A memorial needs to stay alive in a very personal way for people.
And as the rain poured down at the dedication ceremony, Murdoch, family members, friends, and volunteers walked up the hill to ring the chimes publicly for the first time. Lori Guadagno stayed in the rain a little longer to take it in. Her brother Richard was killed on Flight 93. He was a biologist who loved being outdoors, and Guadagno says this feels like a perfect tribute.
Knowing that the sound of their voices is always going to be echoing here. I mean, the wind did it for me from the first time I was here because it's ever present. I always heard it. It was always a part of this site, but to have it put into these beautiful sounds that will radiate forever, it's breathtaking.
When Flight 93 crashed down into this field outside Shanksville, the ground became sacred to the people whose family members died here. To this day, the crash site remains private, fenced off from the rest of the park in an area only family members are allowed to enter. And Guadagno says that's still special to her and to the other families.
We've shared this story with the world. This is a little piece of privacy that I think is essential, and I am glad that is preserved for close family members and friends.
Debbie Borza agrees, though she adds, someday that could change. Part of the beauty of the park, she says, is it'll evolve with future generations.
You know, as long as I'm alive, you know, it will remain the way that it is. And then after I'm gone, then it's left to the next of kin.
Gordy Felt, who heads the organization Families of Flight 93, lost his older brother Edward in the crash. He says he plans to stay as involved with the national park as ever. So he notes the Tower of Voices does bring a sense of completion.
There's also a huge sense of relief that we're there. We committed ourselves to honor our loved ones, and we've done it.
The Park Service has a simulation of what the chimes will sound like when they're all in place. Something like this. Katie Meyer in Stony Creek Township, Somerset County.
President Donald Trump is scheduled to visit Somerset County today to mark the 17th anniversary of the September 11th attacks and give the keynote address at the Flight 93 National Memorial. This is Trump's first visit to the memorial as president. He'll be joined by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke and Governor Tom Wolf. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When all the dollars are tallied in Pennsylvania this year, it could very well be hundreds of millions spent on U.S. House, Senate, gubernatorial races. We're going to talk about where that money is coming from, the implications of its spending with longtime political consultant Abigail Gardner. Welcome, Abigail.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Chris Potter, the editor of WESA's Politics and Government Accountability team. Chris has been adding up the campaign dollars for years. Hi, Chris.
Hi, it's good to see you.
Chris, let's start with you. What races have you been keeping a close eye on regarding campaign fundraising and the spending?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned the big ones, which is the gubernatorial race between Governor Tom Wolf and former state senator Scott Wagner. The U.S. Senate campaign, where Bob Casey, the Democrat and incumbent, faces a challenge from Republican Lou Barletta. Because I'm geeky this way, I'm looking at some of the state legislative races as well. And the 17th district congressional race. That would be Keith Rothfuss and Connor Lamb, the only two incumbents facing each other in November, thanks to Pennsylvania's redistricting this year. So
I alluded to it. Are we going to see record campaign spending when you add all the dollars together, maybe not in any one particular race, but overall? What do you think, Abigail?
Yeah, I think year over year, it tends to be that we beat whatever the previous record total was. So my guess would be that we will see a record year. I know Bob Casey's raised more money than he ever has before. Lou Barletta, his opponent, is not raising so much. So there might be a couple weak, soft candidates who don't really perform. But overall, it'll be a big spending year.
What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting year because what we've got, especially in that gubernatorial side, Tom Wolf came to surfaced on voters' radars as a result of spending his own money. I think he spent about $10 million of his own money just to get himself winning through the primary and positioning himself back in 2014. He now faces Scott Wagner, who really did the same thing and is basically funded out of his own pockets. And one of the sort of interesting quirks, Abigail and I were talking about it before the program here, is the challenges of these rich guys who can write a big check for themselves. And obviously that allows you to buy a lot of TV, but it presents challenges as well for campaigns because you don't have the same kind of organic infrastructure that you might have otherwise.
But does that, on the other hand, does that being able to invest some of your own money help attract outside money or other money, whether it's in-state or from out-of-state? Abigail, you're currently helping out in the race in the 38th State Senate contest, mostly north of Pittsburgh. We're not going to talk about that race specifically, but can you give us a sense of the overall strategy? How does a candidate attract in-state and maybe even particular out-of-state money into Pennsylvania?
Sure. I think it really depends on what level you're running at. If you're running for a high-profile congressional seat like Conor Lamb was when it was a special, out-of-state money is going to flow in. You'll see a lot of donors from California and New York saying, oh, this is a place I can really make a difference. Statewide for U.S. Senate, there's going to be a lot of out-of-state money coming in, too. Once you're through the primary, I think the camps sort of naturally sort themselves. There are interests across the country who are going to be spending in Pennsylvania, especially for a Senate race, kind of regardless of how much you've brought to the table. In a primary, though, when you're trying to establish yourself against your own camp, it's a different story. I don't know if out-of-state money would necessarily be picking winners and losers then.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the challenges for a couple of these Republicans we've just mentioned, Lou Barletta being, I think, Exhibit A, is money attracts money, right? If Lou Barletta and the state Republicans, because they are facing a very difficult November, right? There's a very real chance that Republicans are going to lose the House. Democrats are challenging them in places they haven't.
The U.S. House,
US
the congressional
House, yes,
delegation.
At the congressional level. Republicans have said, the NRCC, which is sort of the national committee that helps Republicans win congressional House races, has said to some of these guys, look, you got to be able to put together your own money. And one of the examples they're citing is the case of Rick Saccone, who was the state representative who Conor Lamb beat in that special election in March. And Abigail's quite right. A ton of money came in part because there wasn't a lot else going on in March on the national scene. Ton of money came in, something like $12 million. Rick Saccone still managed to lose that race. Conor Lamb is advertising right now. I just saw an ad this morning on TV where he says, we beat $12 million of their out-of-state money or whatever. Republicans looked at that race and said, you have to start raising, you got to show us that you're serious. And either you write a check out of your own pocket or you raise it from other folks, or we got other races, we got other playgrounds we could be playing in, and we're just going to leave you to the side. So Barletta's got that challenge, and Keith Rothfuss as well. There's sort of been a lot of mixed signals from Republican groups about whether they want to jump into that or not.
Well, speaking of Keith Rothfuss, according to Medium Buying, which does media buying for political campaigns, the NRCC, the National Republican Congressional Committee that Chris mentioned, is pulling out of ads that had been planned for Republican incumbent Congressman Keith Rothfuss against Conor Lamb that had been already set to run starting tomorrow through October 8th. To both of you, how significant is that, Abigail?
It's not a good sign for Keith Rothfuss. I mean, as Chris was saying, basically these party entities like the NRCC, they have to decide how many they're going to invest in. And it is going to be a wave year. And they're looking at a range of seats. If Keith is in this new seat and Trump only won it by two, I don't want to make a ton of assumptions, but my gut says it's gone. And they know they need to work on the seats that Trump won by 6, 7, even 10 and protect those guys. So, of course, some independent expenditures are going to come in for Keith, but they don't get as good of rates, so it's more expensive for them to run fewer ads. It's not a good sign for the campaign. It's not a vote of confidence.
What is the percentage or the point difference right now in that area?
In terms of polling?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I've seen – I'm blanking on this right now – but Conor Lamb, I think, is up by
double digits.
In the low
up to 10. 10,
I think, yeah. Somewhere in that ballpark.
So, yeah.
Financially, the last report I saw had them about 2 million, somewhere in that range. So they're about equivalent on the money side.
Okay. So is the NRCC giving up on Keith Rothfuss, or is it still a wait and see? Because they do have a hold on the final 4 weeks of the campaign to put in ads. So is it wait and see, or are they giving up?
As Abigail says, it's not a vote of confidence, but these decisions get made. This is a very fluid environment, obviously. So, I mean, they could come back in those final weeks, depending on how polling internally shows up.
Abigail, as a political consultant, what is the NRCC looking for in these 4 weeks where they've pulled out their money in the Rothfuss campaign? Are they looking for some sort of spurt from him, maybe internal dollars that he raises, maybe a point that he makes that sort of resonates with voters?
Well, I think what they need to see is that he's moved the needle, and whether he raises a lot of money, which he does, he's a strong fundraiser. He's on banking committees where he can raise a lot of money from financial institutions like Wells Fargo, which is probably where he'll go work when he loses.
That was a Democratic political consultant speaking there.
I think what they need to see probably is polling moves the needle. So they would need to see the ads that he's running with his own money starts to make a real difference in the polling. And if the numbers tightened up significantly, then maybe they'd come back and invest.
And he has a new ad that could resonate with voters.
He does. It's an ad about his own cancer diagnosis and how he was treated for it. He's done this before. Previous ads have used his mom to good effect there. He's done this before where, I mean—
makes him a person.
Yeah, exactly. Mr. Rothfuss, he's not sort of a glad-handing politician type, and so these ads go a long way to sort of humanizing him. I don't know, now that you're in your his third term, whether that's the approach you should be using, you know, the one you want to be using. I mean, voters ought to know you by this point. So I think it speaks to a certain concern on their part.
All right, let's move on to Harrisburg, the governor's race that we alluded to a little earlier. Incumbent Tom Wolf against Republican nominee Scott Wagner. They're both multimillionaire businessmen. So how much is going to go into the race? You mentioned that Wolf put in a lot of money of his own the first time around. Wagner has the money as a multimillionaire businessman himself to put in money. Planned Parenthood PACT is kicking in a couple million bucks toward Wolf's reelection, and most they've ever spent in any state on a midterm. What should we read from that particular investment?
I think what we know is if Governor Wolf doesn't win again, that the way the legislature is so Republican right now and increasingly conservative in the kinds of Republicans that get elected, that there are interest groups like Planned Parenthood that are so concerned that Pennsylvania could be like Texas tomorrow. We would have a ton of legislation that made it really hard for women to access the health care they were looking for if Scott Wagner was our governor. So I think even if you were a self-funder the first time you ran, once you're an incumbent, these groups that represent unions or corporate interests or social issues, they're going to come in regardless and spend money.
Yeah, and the backdrop of all this, of course, is the Brett Kavanaugh nomination, the fact that the Supreme Court is up for grabs here. There's every reason to think within a couple of years you could have a Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe, kicked this issue back to the states, and then it's kind of off to the races as far as that stuff goes.
So no matter who controls the legislature in Pennsylvania, of course, the Republicans have a good grip on both houses at this point. The abortion rights advocates, they want a governor who will veto anything that comes out of the legislature.
Yeah, the other side too is just, again, Abigail's right, the advantage of incumbency here. I think Wolf has something like $15 million in the bank the last time I looked. He obviously didn't have a primary challenge, whereas Scott Wagner, who's got about a tenth of that amount in the last report left over, Wagner had a tough fight, and he had a tough fight against another self-funded candidate. And part of what, if you talk to party figures, I mean, I talked to Val DiGiorgio, who's the chair of the state Republican Party, and it's that was an issue for him because you can't, back in the days when parties were stronger and money counted for less, you had the ability to kind of discipline your candidates and say, you know what, we are not going to attack each other in this race if you want the support of the party, because we want a strong, whoever wins, we want that person to be strong going in November. You can't control a self-funded candidate that way.
Aside from the fight for abortion access, Abigail, how much do out-of-state contributors usually care about gubernatorial races?
Oh, that's a good question. I think for major national interest groups, like Chris was saying, on something like abortion, where they realize it's going to come down to the states, they're going to invest. But I would say, you know, like Chris said, I'm a Democrat. I work on the Democratic side. This is an area where I don't think Democrats have really gotten the same memo that Republicans got. I think Republicans for a long time knew that their fights were going to be on the state level, and Democrats were really, really federally focused. I think the tide is turning now where they've figured out for a lot of reasons you have to invest on the state level.
We just have a few minutes left. I want to get to the Pennsylvania U.S. Senate race. 2 years ago, that race, the primary and the general election, it became the most expensive of its kind in U.S. history, $164 million total between the Republican Democratic camps. Are we on track to anything near that this time around? Any ideas?
I don't think so. And it's partly it has a lot to do with Lou Barletta not being a particularly assiduous campaign fundraiser.
Is he just not campaigning hard? He's just, you know, some people are good at raising money and others aren't so good.
I mean, I think part of it is he comes from northeastern Pennsylvania. He's been a congressman for a long time. He was sort of content to be in that backyard or whatever. Sometimes candidates have a really hard time. This is hard for outsiders to realize, like, what it takes to kind of scale up. Rick Saccone, raised enough money to be a state representative, but when it came to the congressional level, it was just a whole other plateau he couldn't get to. And maybe we're seeing the same kind of thing with Lou Barletta, although he did kind of change his campaign team over the summer, and maybe they'll have some more luck going forward in the home stretch here.
Well, Bob Casey was not historically a very good fundraiser either.
True.
And this year, he got the message from last cycle's race, but he's really turned it up. So he's sitting on $9 million, $1 million cash on hand. I think there's a discipline to fundraising that a lot of Republicans have gotten away from because they're so used to big independent expenditure money coming in and doing the heavy lifting for them. But you still have to be able to raise the bare bones to run a campaign.
All right. So one more question about this particular race. Outside of Pennsylvania, are people who would like to see Lou Barletta and the Republicans claim that U.S. Senate seat, are they waving the flag yet and just saying the surrender flag and say, no, we'll focus on another U.S. Senate seat elsewhere in the country?
If you raise the surrender flag, it implies that you were fighting in the first place. And I've never gotten a sense, and this is no disrespect to Lou Barletta, there are a lot of seats in play right now. And Bob Casey is not far from the most vulnerable seat in the country. So I don't know that they ever really looked at this race and said, yeah, we're going to get in there and then pulled back. I think there's always been sort of a wait and see. And I don't think the Barletta campaign has shown them what they need yet.
All right. I want to make sure we get to both of you. So in the final 8 weeks, 8 weeks from today, what sort of donations, fundraising tactics overall in any race or overall do you expect to see? Will it all be dumped into TV ads? Is there a smarter buy right now? Could we be surprised at all? Lots of questions. We'll start with you, Abigail.
Well, I will say I apologize to your email inboxes. If you've ever donated to anybody, that means you're on an email list that's going to get sold to a million other campaigns, and you're going to be inundated with fundraising emails. Same with your phone number. If you've been a donor to anybody, you're going to get 1,000 calls asking for money from everybody. I think how you spend it, though, it is an interesting question. You're seeing a lot of different campaigns make different choices depending on how much money they have, which I think is a good thing. They used to dump everything into TV, and that's changing.
Final 30 seconds to you, Chris Potter.
Yeah, I mean, I think to pick up on that, I think one of the interesting effects we're seeing here, and Toomey did this successfully, and Trump did it almost notoriously, is investment in sort of online social media, Facebook-type ads. They tend to we don't have them on their radar in the same kind of way because you can't turn on the morning news and see them there, and they're kind of targeted to specific demographics. But I think increasingly campaigns are getting more and more interested in that approach as opposed to the traditional TV sort of big carpet bombing buys that we're used to seeing.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Politics and Government Accountability Team. Abigail Gardner is a longtime political consultant. Thanks so much to both of you for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Join us on our next show, Airport Authority CEO Christina Cassotas on adding more and more international flights from Pittsburgh International Airport. But why must we pay millions of dollars to subsidize them? And the growing economic and cultural impact of immigrant entrepreneurs in the Pittsburgh region. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.